Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inclusion First Podcast. I am so excited that you're here. We are going to have an amazing conversation. We are talking with a good friend of mine who is deep in the space of diversity, equity, and inclusion, especially when it comes to disability. We have lots of amazing conversations. My friend Rachel is, she is a pistol. Let's just say that. She's very accomplished. She's very talented. And I'm excited for us to have this conversation today and introduce you to her. As a lifelong disability advocate, Rachel Schlesinger, she/her, is committed to ensuring disability is included in diversity and equity initiatives in education, legislation, and nonprofit sectors. She's enthusiastic about educating the community and creating lasting societal change. She lectures at San Diego State University and teaches social sexual education to individuals with developmental disabilities and offers consulting and public speaking to agencies. When she's not working, she is traveling and building up her photography portfolio. That's how I met her, through her photography work, which is incredible. Please join me in welcoming my friend, Rachel. Rachel, thank you so much for being here today on the Inclusion First Podcast.
Thank you, Carrie, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yay. So I'm very excited to have this conversation with you. And how about you start off by just giving us a little bit about who you are, what you do in this world, what you love, why this work is important?
So for me, I work in a lot of different spaces. I predominantly focus in the disability space. That's where my main focus is. I am a person with a disability. I experienced disability myself. My sister also experiences disability. So I'd like to say I'm pretty much a lifelong advocate without really acknowledging that until adulthood. There was many lived experiences up until adulthood that I was advocating and I was doing all of these things, but it really didn't come into fruition and like, oh, this is something I can actually do until adulthood. And so that's been a major shift for me in the last 10 years or so. I teach at San Diego State University. I teach a course called Disability and Society, where I teach 600 students a semester on how society looks at disability and challenging different biases and perspectives students might have about the disability experience. So I spent a lot of my time doing that. I've taught social sexual education to individuals with developmental disabilities. I've worked in day programs. I've worked in different systemic places, doing career counseling, but I've always had a love for higher education.
I love that, and supporting students and helping them find their way and get good information that they can use for whatever they need it for.
Yeah, exactly. That's become kind of, I'm starting to realize as time progresses that that's my main focus and working within the disability space for sure.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for giving us a little peek into the behind the scenes of Rachel. So I would love to jump right in with the kind of two-part question that I love to ask all of our guests when we get started. And that is, today in 2021, what does it mean to you to be an activist? And do you consider yourself to be one?
That's a big question, Carrie. Always asking the big question. So I do consider myself an activist. And it may not look in the same role as most people because I'm more smaller scale right now. So in general, the way I view activism is that you as an individual are doing the active work to make systemic change. And that can be large scale, that can be small scale. It can encompass a lot of different array of different lived experiences. It doesn't have to be in just the racist, you know, anti-racist work of changing things, you know. So for me, a lot of the work I do intersects with so many different efforts to promote inclusion, to promote access. And for me, the main foundation, it falls under disability, but all of that intersects. So I do consider myself an activist on a smaller scale by virtue of more in, and this is going to hopefully change as I develop my own skills and kind of figure out where I want to be when I grow up. but right now, it's predominantly been in higher education the last 10 years or so.
Awesome. All right. So you started to touch on this word, anti-racism. Let's talk a little bit about what that looks like. And I would love to even hear about, from your experiences, the intersection of anti-racism and disability.
So, you know, that's something we'll probably touch on this at some point. You know, being an anti-racist, and I think an activist in general, is doing the tough work, that internal work that we have biases, we have assumptions we make, we have lived experiences by virtue of our family dynamics and where we grew up, where we were raised, what we've been taught to believe about different experiences of others. And I believe from a foundational perspective that the anti-racist work starts with the individual first. And so for me, it's that internal challenging those outdated perspectives or things that I've completely been far off the rails on. And, you know, it's an ongoing work. It's an ongoing practice. It's this practice of cultural humility and recognizing that you don't know it all of everyone's lived experience. That's impossible. And so not only is it the internal work that you have to do, but then also making the active effort to play a role in, you know, enhancing the lives of all others, because we share our world with other people. It's just not me and my own nucleus of a family. I intersect with people in all every single day, strangers. You're crossing paths. And so when we talk, you know, for me, that intersection with disability is a key piece. You know, and I've been invited, I sit on committees for diversity and inclusion and diversity and equity, and I'm very passionate about the work because I do believe there is work to be done. A point of frustration, I think, for me is the fact that oftentimes in these efforts, this anti-racist work to make systemic changes, to make big, you know, change policies, to change legislation, the disability community is often the one that's the most overlooked. And disability does not discriminate at all. And yet these different organizations, different efforts, it's not like we are intrinsic. Most people are not intrinsically, you know, forgetting the disabled community, but it just goes to show you where, as a society, where we are. You know, if you're hyper-focused on anti-racist work, you're so caught up on, okay, we've got to get to this goal for this community, but forget that the disability community is one of the major, it's a major aspect of this diversity and equity work as well. And so for me, it's including all aspects of, you know, diversity when we're doing this anti-racist work. It's not an easy process and it can be very overwhelming. I've experienced that overwhelmingness from peers who are so focused on diversity and equity and they don't touch on disability. And then I show up and they're like, I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
So I think for me, that's ultimately what I've, you know, my own ideas of what anti-racist, you know, work can look like or, you know, be like. And it's certainly an ongoing learning process. It doesn't just, you're not just an anti-racist because you read a book. It's not because you talk to a person and like, oh, I get the full lived experience. No, like it, you have to commit. It's a commitment, an ongoing commitment to learning and being willing to self-reflect on the things that are tough in our own minds and hearts.
I love all the things that you said. There was so much in there. And I think it's just really interesting because we do get totally trapped in our own silos of focus, and we forget about the other intersections that are there, especially ones that don't come up in conversation all the time. And such a huge, and this is, please correct me if I'm wrong, but a large part of disability are unseen disabilities. Like there's tons and tons of unseen disabilities. So you think everyone's walking around in a certain way, but they're actually not. Right. And so this is impacting a lot of people, and is another way, another lever for us to create more space, to create more voices and bring more experiences to the table as we're creating this systemic change and building that world, you know, that we want to see that is accepting of everyone, but not just accepting, like aware of everyone. And I think that what you said about, you know, you're never going to understand all the lived experiences or anyone else's really lived experiences besides yours. And there are so many in this idea of cultural humility, just being a sponge and listening versus trying to judge if it's right or wrong, if it's possible, did it really happen like that? Like none of, whenever you feel yourself going into like that kind of mode, it's really about pausing and like starting over because it's just not our place. And in this work of equity, of inclusion, of facilitating more diverse spaces, like it's not about people having to prove things. It's about we're all here, our experiences are valid, and they're happening regardless of whether you've ever heard of it or not.
Correct. And I would even say it's beyond awareness at that point. You know, we've been doing awareness work for years, not only as a disability community, but the civil rights movement. All of these things have intersected for years and years. It's so much more than that now, that now people want action, you know, and I'm sure for you, Carrie, and the work you're doing, like now people are wondering like, okay, what's next? We are aware these issues are here, but what do we do about it? And that's where it's an ongoing thing. What do we do about it?
Mm-hmm. And I love what you said earlier about like, you don't just read a book and you become anti-racist. And anti-racism isn't like it's not a set state. It's really something that we're striving to, because racism is existing in so many different facets of our life. It's not possible to be perfect in every single facet at the same time. Needless to say, they're not all happening at the same time either. And this idea of there are some things where I have a high competency and other places where I have like, basically I'm clueless and I'm saying stupid things and tripping over my own feet. Right. And then what do I do? Like, do I put my head in the sand, or do I take those same steps that I took in these other categories and actually learn what I need to do, what I need to know in order to become an ally, to be more informed, to be more of a support than a hindrance as these other groups make their way forward as well.
Oh, definitely. It's an ongoing, I like to say life is a journey. And in this work, it's a journey. It's a practice. So keep on keeping on.
Yes, for sure. So can you tell us a little bit more about the different change that you are facilitating in the world through your work?
Sure. So a lot of the work that I do, it's been interesting. I have a very medical, some would argue a very medical background, by virtue of the fact that I have my bachelor's in speech, language, and hearing sciences. And I realized quickly that this was not what I want to do, because I thought that was very too medicalized for me. I am much more progressive in my view of disability by the fact that I have a sister who experiences disability, and I myself experienced disability, and I didn't acquire my disability until I was really, I'd say until I think I was 18 or 19 years old. And I went through my own transition of figuring out where I am in the world and the global space and looking at my sister's experience. And so for me, it was the change that I make. It started slow, and then it eventually evolved from, you know, getting this bachelor's in speech, language, and hearing sciences and progressing into getting a master's in rehabilitation counseling. And I will be the first one to tell you that's still a very medicalized approach to the work I do. Hence why I'm not necessarily doing that work. I have all the certificates, I have the master's, I have all on paper, But the work that I'm focused on is not only one, it's one, engaging my students. So I have a lot of students, almost 1,000 students or a little over 1,000 every semester that I get to educate on a totally different perspective on disability. It's not through this lens of pity. It's not like, oh, the disabled community needs our help. You know, I am in the helping field, but most of my colleagues, they'll be the first one when you ask them, why are you doing the work that you do? Oh, because I want to help others. No, that's not what I'm here for. Yes, in the collective aspect, I want to help and change things, but my work is to really change the system. I want to change the ableist policies, the ableist legislation, the discriminatory practices that are happening that intersect with different identities. Not only just in higher education. I mean, ultimately, it would be cool if I can make some real, you know, impactful changes in terms of systemic change. But I know I can't do it alone. You know, we are a community. And so a lot of the work that I've been doing, not only is just, you know, it starts small with teaching. That's one way to make some change. And then also really sitting on a lot of committees and working with others just like yourself to really expand the efforts to put disability on the forefront and part of these diversity and equity conversations, because it's really disheartening from someone who experiences disability that we are often overlooked in this work, and that needs to change.
So what would you say has been really the most effective way that you've seen to bring disability, the voices, the needs to these tables that are really hyper-focused on other intersections?
Well, me, I'm kind of a strong personality, so I find my way into these spaces. But it's really, you know, a lot of times it comes down to access. So many of these spaces are not accessible for people with disabilities, and they don't provide the accommodations or the option to provide accommodations. And so what I found in a lot of these spaces, it's not that people are inherently ableist. People are not intentionally, especially with the disability community, trying to necessarily discriminate, but there's a fear. There is an inherent, there's just a fear and a lack of awareness and understanding about what the disability experience is like, maybe many broad assumptions that are made without asking individuals themselves. So for example, maybe lack of captioning could be one. Not having event spaces where there's alternate text, or social media efforts to have alternate text on Instagram and Facebook. It's also having different modalities of allowing people to express. So there's different communication needs. There are people that communicate with tablets and they type to speak. Now, for a lot of spaces, that's very intimidating. And it's unfortunate because they just not been exposed to that. But we need to create a space for people of all different, you know, backgrounds can have a space to really thrive and provide an opportunity and create the bare minimum that access is a fundamental right to being in these spaces. And for a lot of corporations and a lot of companies, they don't know how to do that. And they look at it. So it's like with my students, we have accommodations. Many faculty members come to us and say, what do you do about this person who has this disability? I said, I just have a standard. Everybody gets the same treatment. And if someone has an accommodation, I open it up for everyone, because if it's going to benefit them, it's going to benefit someone else. So it's not, I don't try to seek out one person with a disability. I wouldn't want that. Oh, you're just going to accommodate me? Like, no, create a baseline and then work from there. It's never going to be perfect, but this is why the more we create safe spaces and people feel like they can share, hey, I need this to be in this space, there is more of a push to kind of get, you know, it's really, it's not the individual's role to force themselves into the space. I have that personality. These spaces need to have the doors open and provide access for people without having people disclose or explain or get defensive. That's not necessary. There should just be a standard universal access in these spaces.
Yeah, I love what you do when an accommodation is needed, like you, that opening that up. And I think that speaks so much to the value of accessibility and the fact that there's always a ton of other people who need that same thing for different and valid reasons as well. And so you think you're like making some special thing, but really you're helping like a good like 20, 30% of the people who are using this anyways, because it's just good design in so many cases.
Correct. And the other thing too is people are so, not everyone that you meet, yes, they might medically have a disability, but they may not identify as part of the disability culture and community. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of fear. There's, you know, fear of retaliation is real, or feeling like you're a burden within the space. I hope to never create that as that to never be the situation for my own students and for any space that I'm in, that people are afraid to. I want them to know that I'm doing my hardest to really create access. And there are mistakes. I mean, in my class, I've made mistakes where I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot to record a lecture. Or, oh my gosh, I forgot to turn on the captions. You know, you do what you can. We're human. It's never going to be perfect. But the idea is to really practice that openness and willingness to try. Yeah. And take a risk. It's a risk. You're taking risks, but sometimes risks have great rewards.
Creating that safe space for people to feel like they can ask for what they need. And I don't know like that there's one right way to do that. I don't know that it's even always possible, right? Because of the power dynamics and the things that people have that are at stake, and, you know, both parties needing to come to some sort of agreement. But in the cases where it is possible, how do you create those safe spaces for people to feel like, hey, I can say what I need? And then also, I'm just wondering, like, how many people don't even know that they can ask for something or what to ask for? I feel like there's probably a huge amount in that space. I know, like, when I was in high school, I was diagnosed with a learning disability around numbers. It was this random thing where it was a form of dyslexia. I still have it. But if I'm talking out loud, I don't transpose numbers. But if I'm writing it, I do, which wreaked havoc on all of my math and science. And there was a certain point where I was tested. And then my parents, remember them telling me that this happened and then asking me if I wanted some kind of help. And I'm in like high school, I'm a freshman. I'm like, I don't want to be different. I don't want any help. And so we just pretended that I didn't have a learning disability and I never got any help for it. And to the point where I even, like, I forgot. Like, I was like a year ago, I'm like, I have a learning disability. Like, you know, it was shoved down and shoved away. And it wasn't also explained in a way where I understood. I'm sure my parents weren't explained what it was in a way that made them feel like, okay, this is something that this young Black girl in this mostly white school, yeah, she could totally like have a learning disability as well as these other intersections that are working against her. That sounds like a great idea. So I get why my parents were afraid and we just like pushed all help away. And then that's just was my reality for the rest of my life.
No, so. And that's so common in the special education system. You know, the Black community is disproportionately, and the Latino community are disproportionately put in special ed and not provided the same resources. Like, it's not just like in higher ed, it's been ongoing. So many of our students at this point, they come to us and they don't really know how to speak up. There's other professors that might not be as receptive. There's this false idea that people who have accommodations are somewhat lazy or taking advantage of the system. But no, like these accommodations are there to benefit you. But it unfortunately puts, you know, even the way people have to ask for accommodations, you have to provide a medical letter, get a diagnosis. If you don't have resources to go to a professional to get that diagnosis, you cannot get
covered by your insurance. So.
Yeah. You can't get accommodations. I have students right now that need accommodations for their other classes, because if they tell us they have a disability, I believe, I'm not going to argue with someone. I could care less. What does it do for me? You know, like, as long as you're succeeding, whatever, as long as you're not cheating on the class, you know, you're fine. But for other professors, that's not necessarily the case. So this issue of access, this issue of disparities and resources and different cultural values too. I have students that will not go because their family is like, in our culture, there's not even a word for disability. And that's a heavy thing, because I also have to acknowledge that I come from a perspective that's very multicultural, you know, diversity based. I'm very open. And, you know, for me, okay, the disability is part of my language, but for some cultures, they don't even have the word for it. And I have to recognize that.
Wow. Yeah. So creating the openness, but then letting everyone, I'm like missing the metaphor, but letting everyone come as needed, but also not judging if they don't, because we are all navigating through these different value systems, structures, constraints, all of these different things. And it's about the access, and that's the choice, right? The choice to use or not use, to have or not have, but that lies with you and not anyone else. What has been one of the most important things that you have learned while doing this work?
This is so hard for me.
You can have two if you want.
All right, let's see. Let me think about this for a second. So I guess for me, it's one of the most important things is that it's hard work. I didn't think it was going to be this hard. And especially in the last year and a half we've had with the pandemic and all of the just the racial divide that has been, you know, brought to light and the justice fights and all of these things, the burnout is real. And in the last year or so, I think the most important thing that I've learned is not only just my own self-care, but also acknowledging the privilege that I can step back from some of this and you know, when I need to recalibrate in order for me to come back full-heartedly. But that I think when I was looking back at my younger self, I thought the work was easy. I really did. And it's been a hard reality check with how hard it is to change systems, how much more complex it is to educate people of how to make really lasting change. And I thought, okay, if we as the disabled community speak up and if we talk about the intersectional issues, people will want to work with us. I honestly thought that, and I was naive. I was young. I didn't know. And to find out that that's not necessarily the case has, you know, it's been a paradigm shift that this isn't just going to be, oh, I have this job, I can do this, and then once I'm done, it's over, right? It's a lifelong effort. And so I've just learned not only to practice that cultural humility, practice that self-care, but also acknowledge the things I don't know, and that's okay. And that I think for me is one of the most important things I've learned, is that there is so much I don't know. I know a lot about the disability experience, and I know a lot of, you know, a good amount of some aspects of intersectionality with other spaces, but I don't know it all. And I'm going to be a lifelong learner in this and lifelong activist in this work, so that I hope I can make a small influence, whatever it may be, whether it's an individual or a community. I hope that I can have some influence in that.
Yeah. I think what you said is really important. And that is around this idea that you thought that it was going to be easy, and that when you talked with people about the needs of your community, people would want to work with you. And I think that, we see it everywhere, but it's this mindset that we're playing this like zero sum game in life, where if you get more, then I get less. And so if I help you, that means that I'm not able to help myself. If you get that grant, I don't get it. There's only so much to go around. And I mean, that's what's breaking us, honestly. This is not a sustainable system. Capitalism is not sustainable. It will explode itself. And we're, you know, we're seeing that with the racial awakening that has happened. Like, it's about the power of many and everyone figuring out what their role is and coming together, this collective power. And as we are focusing on anti-racism, why not focus on other things? Because none of us are one thing. Like, I can't just focus on race because I'm also a female. I'm also this, I'm also that. Like, none of us are focusing just on one thing. And so how do we create this lattice that allows us to pull each other up as we move? And one of the things that, you know, I talk about in the anti-racist research that I'm doing is like, you don't have to like learn how not to be sexist, how not to be ableist, how not to be homophobic, and how not to be anti-racist as separate silos. Like, this all comes from the exact same skill set. And so as we are learning this skill set, how do we clasp hands, for lack of a better visual, and pull up those people around us? Because we have to. We can't keep stepping on each other to get to where we want to go. We have to step with each other.
No, it's true. And there's like this huge misconception. There's so much, it really is like that. There's so many, it's just like you said, we are not all one thing, right? We all have different identities and so many complex things happening. Finances are as a major part across all of these different groups. Financial security isn't guaranteed, you know, and access to opportunities, higher education, school, good schools, good jobs that pay you well and equitably. Healthcare.
Good healthcare, because that matters too.
Yes. And so it's just all of these things. It's so much more complex. And so I think that's where it's hard. And people are afraid because they're tired. We're tired of fighting, especially certain generations. If you've had family members that have experienced depressions, you know, for years and years, and then you're still fighting generations later, generational trauma is real. You know, my grandfather, he's passed away now. He was a Holocaust survivor. And even though I'm not necessarily, you know, the most Jewish person out there, I learned a lot from that experience too, of like, there's still a lot of things in that work and in the Jewish community where things need to, there's generational trauma that is carried over, and that's not something we take lightly. So it can be exhausting if you've been part of a major group that's been oppressed historically in very traumatic ways. It's very, very hard to just focus on other things because you're trying to work out the things in your own community to set history straight.
So for these groups, for people who are, you know, carrying the generational torch, if you will, forward and trying to create change in, you know, today's constraints and new traumas and new environment. How do we take care of ourselves? Like, what does self-care look like for a person who has identities that are oppressed or marginalized or underestimated?
I would say that acknowledge that it's okay to take a break. We, you know, in this capitalist society, we are conditioned to work ourselves to the grave. We are not valued as human beings to just pause and focus. And that's hard. Even for me, I'm currently between jobs. I left a job that didn't serve me, and now I'm in this space trying to figure it out. It was an adjustment to be like, it's okay to not work a bunch. It's okay to relax. I have that privilege because I've worked hard to kind of save up, you know, so that I could do that. But people don't have that. And if you're focusing on these big systemic issues, you want to keep fighting. You don't want to seem weak in your plight to justice. But sometimes we do have to pause and care for ourselves and nurture what we need in order for us to come out back out and fight. You know, I had a hiatus in a lot of the advocacy work that I did for a couple of years because I was so burnt out. It drained me. It was starting to impact my own mental health that I took a break, because in the world of justice, there's people fighting back. There's battles that are being had, and there's people throwing things at you. And that is a lot. And I don't believe that it's a sign of weakness if you need a break. I do not believe that at all. But that's a misconceived notion. You know, there's advocates who'd say, you should be fighting the fight. You have the privilege to stop. But I'm like, no, my mental health is my right. I have the right to care for myself. So I encourage people to care for yourself first, you know, and then the work's always going to be there. There's the fight still out there, and people are still fighting the fight.
Yeah. Knowing that it's not all on my shoulders, it's on our shoulders. And so as I take a break, someone who maybe already took a break gets to step forward. Right. And so we're doing this handoff and this shuffle. I do think that self-care, I mean, this would be an amazing panel to have, like, what does self-care look like in the age of social justice and fighting against this notion that you can't stop. And if you do stop, you're not doing it right. Or you're like abusing your privilege or. We should do that panel for sure.
Oh, definitely. I'm with it. I'm
Carrie. awesome, Rachel. This is really amazing. So I want to ask you, we've got here so much about who you are and the work that you're doing, all the amazing disability stuff and the impact they're having on students, that being, you know, your special place as well, which I think is amazing. For someone who's trying to figure out where their space is, like where they can take a stand, where they can insert themselves, whether it's in a small way or a large way, it doesn't matter. It's really about being there and doing the work. What advice would you have for that person who is looking and isn't sure how or even that they can make a difference?
You know, I was in that space when I was younger. I didn't know who I was going to be. I still don't know who I was going to be. And I get students that are always lost. They're always lost of like, I have to be a certain person at this certain time. We have these timelines we want to meet in our lives. And you want to make a change, but you're not exactly sure where to start. I always tell my students, either go with your gut or just try new things. Try some spaces out. You know, for me, I tried to really be an advocate for a few years in the LGBTQ space. And for me, I was like, you know, I love the work. I'm all about it. But I realized my strengths were in disability because of my own lived experience, because I've been advocating for years, that I tried it. You have to try things. We can't be afraid to take risks on things. And there's just, you know, you might find yourself in a space where you go to one meeting, especially, you know, you go to one meeting or one event, or you learn about something new. It can be start as small as a book. It can start online. I have a lot of individuals right now, they, because of the pandemic and their, as people with disabilities, they have compromised immune systems. They could not go to the Women's March. They could not do the Black Lives Matters, you know, they could not be... Yeah, they could not be out in those spaces because their health and well-being was their lives were compromised. And so it can be small as in your own home, online, and, you know, you can volunteer at different organizations. I started at food banks. I was feeding, you know, people who didn't have homes or stable housing. And, you know, it started there and then I grew different interests through the years, but it doesn't have to be a linear process to end up where you're going to be. I still don't know where I'm going to be tomorrow, let alone when I grow up. and I went to school to see where I was going to be when I grew up and it didn't work out that way. Like,
still don't know.
It's okay to try different things.
No, I love that. You know, start where you are and see what interests spark for you and starting small too. You don't have to go and do anything. It doesn't have to look a particular way. Like you were saying, it is more about starting that journey and then seeing what sparks for you. Like, and as simple as that, because racism and ableism and all these other isms are sprinkled and scattered and splattered throughout so many spaces. You could literally pick anything and it matters.
Anything. It follows you around. So you never escape it. Like, even though I'm focused in disability world, racism is always an underlying thing that we are constantly talking about.
Yeah, it's so you can pick anything and you're needed there, because if that's a thing that calls for you, then that's a thing that you're supposed to do at that time. So no, I totally appreciate that. I think that's really good advice. Start small and try things out. Try new things.
Yeah. And your lived experiences will change things too. I can tell you, I had totally different views when I was, 15, 16, 17 years old in high school. I am not that same person. So your lives and what you stand for can take a complete, what is it? I'm not good with math. 360, 180. 180. It's going to be the opposite.
It's turning.
you know, so it. You don't have to be a set person. And that's what I've learned. You don't have to be a set person. You can change. And as your views change and as things you learn more, you can take up different spaces. So that's okay.
Rachel, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing yourselves and your insights with us today. If people want to get more Rachel, like follow your work, take your class, where can they find you? How can they connect with you?
Well, they can start it with LinkedIn. I'm a lot easier to access there because it's pretty broad and not everyone has access to me on the university. So my full name is Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L. My last name is S-C-H-L-E-S Inger, Rachel Schlesinger. That's predominantly the space I'm taking. And hopefully in the next few months, there might be some changes in the horizon. We'll see where life takes me. But I would say start there, reach out to me, connect with me there. And I'd love to hear from anybody and everybody.
Awesome. Rachel, you are amazing. Thank you so much for this today.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.